So I want to open up with an image, maybe of two different people, similar image. The one is, you know, the stereotypical person who is struggling to eat healthier, and they keep finding themselves face to face to a succulent morsel, to a donut, to a cheesecake, to candy, to whatever. And sometimes they're able to summon up the willpower to say no, but more often than not, he finds himself partaking. And so you get this interesting picture. You have this person who wants to do something, and yet he finds himself not doing it. A similar picture, you know, the other stereotypical picture of someone who's overworking, just working constantly, nonstop. Actually, think of Beethoven as an example. He worked notoriously hard. It contributed to some of his health problems, allegedly. And there's this idea that you know you're not supposed to be pushing yourself this much, and you want to slow down, and every part of you in your mind is saying, slow down, stop, do something a bit differently, but it's almost like it's ingrained in you that you just keep doing it over and over and over and over, and keep pushing and keep pushing. And so, two different pictures, but it's the same problem. You know you want to do something, and you find yourself doing something else. So I want to ask the question here, has anyone ever had a disconnect between what you know and what you do? Zero people. Okay, one person here has. Okay. I'm assuming that that's the case for most of us. Seems to be the case for most of humanity. That sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes you know something's right, or you know that there's an ideal, or you know things would be better if, and yet you find yourself doing something completely different. And so I want to explore tonight and today's sermon, why is this the case? And what is actually going on here when this happens? So take the guy who's trying to eat healthier and, you know, 8 out of 10 times he succumbs to the temptation. What's going on? And actually, there's a lot of stuff going on. And a lot of it comes down to how you picture what it means to be a human being. In other words, anthropology. What does it mean to be a human being? Somehow you have one person here whose desires or at least intentions seem conflicted. How does all that exist? What's going on? And lots of people have had lots of different explanations for how and why that happens. All of them are, you know, can debate the merits, demerits of all of them. If you're going particularly Greek or Hellenistic, you know, you have this picture of the soul where there's three parts. There's a rational part. There's, it's called the irascible part, and then there's like this kind of base desire part. And all these parts of the soul kind of, you're trying to bring them in harmony, but a lot of times it doesn't work. And so that's one model of a human being. Paul actually talks about this in a scriptural model. He talks about this in Romans, in terms of flesh versus spirit. You know, I want to do what I can't do what I want, all of that stuff. That is one way to look at it, and that one, you know, has the benefit of being scriptural, so that's a plus. But I'm going to be looking at it from a different lens, a different take that the scriptures talk about this problem. So, going back to the person who overeats, the person who overworks, a lot of the problems that we find ourselves in, especially when we're trying to do something new, we're trying to change our life for the better, we're trying to be a new type of person, a lot of the problem is that by default, okay, I'm going to preface this. A lot of what I am actually going to be talking about comes from a theologian. His name is James K.A. Smith. So I'm going to mention the actual book that I get this from, but it would spoil the, you know, one of the big takeaways. So I'll mention the title of it later. But a lot of it comes from him. So there's our, what is that, whatever it's called. Disclaimer, thank you. Okay, so why do we find ourselves in this situation? We want to change our character. We want to aim for something higher, but we keep falling lower over and over and over. And oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, it's because we've accepted a picture of what it means to be human that is actually relatively modern, relatively recent. It's this idea that we are fundamentally thinking things. Fundamentally, when you boil it down, we are things, we are creatures, we are something that thinks, that processes information, that takes in information. All of the things that happen in this mental sphere, that is who we are. for those of you who are interested in the historical, you know, footnotes, this comes from a thinker, René Descartes. The name might sound familiar. He's the guy who had the maxim, I think, therefore I am, which is a very interesting maxim. We can talk about that at some point. But later, he deduces from that maxim that fundamentally, humans are thinking things. Of course, there's, you know, this relationship. We're very closely intertwined with our body and with all this material stuff, but that's actually fundamentally separate from who we are at the core. We are thinking things. So everything else is just extra. And that's been really picked up by a lot of society today. We think of the mind, the brain, the intellect as kind of mission control, almost like the nucleus of the cell that sends out the information and the orders, takes in information, the commander standing at the helm of a ship. And there's some benefits to that, but I'm going to posit that that's fundamentally a misunderstanding of the type of creatures that God created us to be. And if that's wrong, we'll talk about why it might be wrong later, if that's wrong, then this is going to lead to wrong views of ourselves, wrong views of our motivations, wrong views of discipleship, wrong views of everything that pertains to being human, and especially wrong views of how to change our lives for the better. Because if we're fundamentally thinking things, the metric of change, when I want to aim for the stars, so to say, to use the proverbial phrase, I want to aim for something better, and if I'm fundamentally a thinking thing, what do I have to do? Think. Maybe gain information, go learn about the topic. I have to think my way to success. That's the metric of change implicit within this model of being human. If I have the right information, I will make the right decisions. I'll repeat that again. If I have the right information, I will make the right decisions. And if you can tell with the two examples that we talked about, the guy who overeats, the guy who is overworking, and countless other examples that perhaps you've experienced, I know I've experienced, that's just not how it is. I find myself saying, I have the right information, I know exactly, like, this is the type of guy I want to be, and I just find myself not able to get there. So if I want to improve myself, I will learn more. I will acquire the right information. If I want to be more spiritual, and I'm fundamentally a thinking thing, then I'll consume more content about God. I will do more, I don't know, I was going to say Bible studies, but that's actually a nuanced thing. We might talk about that later. Pretty much, I'll consume more content. The more information about God that I can put into my head, the more spiritual that will be. That's like a, it's like translation. Information comes in here, spirituality comes out the other side. Notably, too, if I want to disciple somebody, if I want to lead someone into the kingdom and help guide them and help guide their transformation, I just have to fill their heads with the correct information. And that will beget right action, right motivation, right, you know, everything. That's the solution. And again, if those of you who have brought someone in the kingdom or labored to and the person decided not to, a lot of us have experienced frustrations with that where it's like, man, I've just given them all the right information. I've given them all the keys that they need to know and they're just still, they're not biting. They're not, they don't care. Something's not translating. And so, again, I'm positing that it's because that's the wrong model of humanity. God did not fundamentally make us as thinking things, as, yeah, creatures who are defined by their thoughts, by the information that they consume. That type of model is the type of model that produces the, you know, the gap that we talked about between what I want to do and what I actually do. Sam Smith called it the model of sputtering motivation. Have you ever heard a killer sermon and you're all inspired and you're like ready to go take on the world and then by Wednesday things have fallen flat, by Friday you've pretty much forgotten it, by next Monday it's completely gone. So, yes, I've seen at least one person nodding their head. For a, you know, yeah, another example is, you know, the proverbial New Year's resolutions. I go to the gym, I like to work out. Find it a source of, you know, help mental health, physical health, all that stuff. And there's this kind of running joke among people that go to the gym that January is the worst time to go because you have all of these excited people that have made New Year's resolutions to do X, Y, and Z, and it's packed and tons of people. And if you can just wait till February, most of those people are gone. So that's this type of model. So The problem is, as someone has put it, you can't think yourself out of problems that you didn't think yourself into. And we'll unpack that as we go. You can't think yourself out of problems that you didn't think yourself into. In fact, if you have ever, if you were to attend an AA meeting, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, one of the phrases you might hear is, your best thinking is what got you here. So, laying all that out as the situation. Now, if we turn to the scriptures don't present human beings as that. In a lot of ways. That's a whole sermon. There's a lot of good books. Hannah and I have been reading a few. Talks about, you know, what does it mean to be a human being, anthropology, all that stuff. But fundamentally, the scriptures do not talk about it that way. I'll just give you a few examples. At a very minimum, if that was who we are, you know, fundamentally thinking things, then Jesus had a really weird ministry. He had a lot of ambiguous statements. He was not necessarily just providing, actually not at all, providing like a systematic theology of like, here's all the information. And if it was just a matter of information, then we might not have even needed Jesus. You know, we could have had Elijah or Isaiah just come down and say, here's actually what you need to know, you're good to go. But more than that, what is the imagery of identity? That's a vague question. I have an answer, so I'll just give it to you. The scriptures use the imagery of fruit, all the way throughout the scriptures, from the Old Testament through the New Testament, this idea of fruit. So think of Psalms 1:1. Was it, blessed is the man who walks in the counsel, what is it? Now I'm all of a sudden forgetting it. Yes, not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. On it he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree planted by still waters, who gives fruit in its season. So there's one picture. We have the fruits of the Spirit. We have Jesus talking a lot about fruit. And what's the interesting thing about fruit? That you don't just decide, you don't just say, today I'm going to produce a fruit, and poof, there it is. In fact, you're not producing fruit all of the time. The psalm says that you produce fruit in your season. It's this idea that fruit comes from who you are. Fruit is an extension of your nature. It's the nature of an apple tree to produce fruit in its season, to produce apples in its season. And so fruit is a lot more of an organic picture of what it means to, you know, live the spiritual life. That the fruit is that which comes from who you are, to put it in a, you know, I don't know, philosophically jargon. So you don't wake up one day, look at the facts, and then decide, I'm going to bear fruit, but fruit naturally comes from someone's character. And that's why the psalm directs us. Don't do this, but meditate on the law of the Lord day and night. Do all of these things. And if you live this type of life, you become the type of person that bears fruit. So there's this relationship between action and identity. We'll talk a lot about that. Okay, so to be more specific in what I'm trying to communicate, let's look at 2 Peter 1:5. This is, you don't have to turn there, it's just one passage. It's kind of that, one of my favorite passages in Scripture. It's the chain of addition, so to say. I'm sure there's a specific name of it, but it's the whole add to your faith, this, add to that, this, add to that, this, add to that, this, 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 this. You guys familiar with that? Okay, so the starting point is faith. That should be, you know, self-explanatory. To start the spiritual walk, you have to believe that there's something more than where you're at. That what you have and what you can see in front of you isn't sufficient, and that things can and should be better than they are. That you have faith in something. There's something better, and as you grope and you grasp, as you know the language of Acts puts it, eventually as you follow that path, you come to find God, you come to all of these things. But you have to believe that there's something beyond yourself that you can devote yourself to. If any change is going to happen, a North Star, so to say, that you can direct your life on, that you can orient your life around and follow until it leads, you know, proverbially to the manger, just like the wise men. They followed the star, and as you go and go and go, eventually it'll lead you to the manger, where is the king who is goodness himself. And indeed, the scripture's right, but without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Okay, so faith is the starting point. It makes sense. Once you have faith, where's the very next place you go? What do you add to your faith? Virtue. And what do you add after virtue?
Knowledge.
Knowledge. Okay, so you see that trajectory. You start with faith, and oftentimes when we're discipling, or when we're thinking, okay, like I've got faith, I know what I want to do, now I'm going to like do the research, or now, you know, they believe in God, so let's like brain dump the scriptural themes and the, you know, past all of this stuff, let's brain dump everything. But that's actually getting it in reverse. You don't go from faith and add to your faith knowledge and add to your knowledge virtue, all that stuff. Peter wants us to add to our faith virtue. So why not knowledge first? And it's because we're not fundamentally thinking things. We're not, quote, brains on a stick. We're far more complex. And so to understand why we should add virtue, we need a new anthropology. If we're not thinking things, what are we? What did God create us to be? Where do our actions come from? Okay, so the Proverbs and Jesus Christ give us a very helpful indicator of where actions spring from in our life. So Jesus, in Luke 6:45, says, "The good person, out of the good treasure of his heart, produces good. And the evil person out of the evil treasure produces evil, for out of the abundance of the heart, so the mouth speaks." Matthew 15:18-19, "But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, and slander." Then Proverbs 4:23 puts it more starkly than any of that. It says, "Above all else, guard your heart. For everything you do flows from it." Everything you do flows from it. And so, that's a radical difference than what we might think. It'd be like, above all, guard like the ideas that are coming in, guard your mind, be on the lookout for these wrong ideas. No, above all, guard your heart. And let's do a very quick gloss for what heart means, because we think of today, heart, is this like some anti-intellectual thing and we should just follow our feelings? No, that's not what's going on here. So the Greek word is cardia. So, you know, cardiovascular, cardiac arrest, those types of things. So all coming from cardia, the heart. And it's not so much the place of feelings as it is the place of your core identity, the visceral kind of gut of who you are, the deepest parts of you. And the Psalms bring this out. Psalm 139 says, "Search me, God, and know my heart. Know the deepest parts of me. And test me, and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Proverbs 20:5, says that the purposes of a person's heart are deep waters, but one who has insight draws them out. And so the heart, in this sense, is our deepest inclinations. The entirety of our inner life, oftentimes at like a semi-subconscious level where the psalmist is saying, "Hey God, search me, test me, see if there's something there," because the heart is so deep. And Jeremiah says the heart is so desperately wicked. There's so much stuff going on in the heart that it's hard to actually figure out what's there. 1 Corinthians 4:5 says, "Therefore do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness, and will disclose the purposes of the heart." And so it's this idea that out of the heart springs who we are, springs what we do, springs the words we say, springs our very identity. And oftentimes, it's an identity that we're not even ourselves familiar with. And that at the very last day, God will reveal the purposes of our hearts. God will shine light on everything. And so that raises a whole new anthropology, a whole new picture of what it means to be human. That we are not fundamentally thinking things, we are fundamentally desiring things. We're fundamentally loving things. Things that are oriented around desire and love. And so the book that James K.A. Smith writes that I'm getting a lot of this from is You Are What You Love. So it's fantastic. I would definitely recommend it. And so, the idea is that we go where our desire takes us. Even the idea of, like, I'm going to add a bunch of information to my life, I'm going to, like, take in all this content, you're looking at that content because even before that, you have a desire for something. Your desire is what's directing you where you are going. Augustine says, we are all restless until we are at rest in God. That's a paraphrase. And so it's this idea that we're all looking around and we're all desiring. And Ecclesiastes says, you set eternity in our hearts. We're all looking around and desiring something. And until we find rest in God, we continually feel restless. Because it's not a matter of information, it's a matter of desiring the one for whom we are made. And until we find that, we're going to be restless. And so you can think of our desires as like a compass. Our desires guide where we're going. They're the things that point, you know, our proverbial north. And the world understands this, actually. Think of a political campaign. We just went through a very, you know, to use a mild word, exciting, political campaign in the United States. And if you were following it, if you had the misfortune of following it, how much did either candidate present information to the voters? Very little, if any. We'll be generous and say a small amount. Because they know that the voters aren't interested in having like all the right information. They are desiring creatures. And so they understand it. The political campaigns know this. And so instead of giving you all the right information that you're going to rationally make your decision on, they give you a narrative that shapes your desires. Narratives of security. Narratives of progress, narratives of national pride, narratives of revenge, whatever it is, they're giving you a narrative that they can subsume your desire and say, come along with me, we're all going to go together. I'm about to quote a guy who has a French name, and it's between a rock and a hard place. You either sound really pretentious by saying the French name, or you sound really obnoxious by saying it with a weird accent. So either Antoine de Saint-Exupéry or Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. So between a rock and a hard place. You might know him, you might not, as the author of The Little Prince, the children's book, Le Petit Prince. He says, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. That if you're in charge of an organization, you don't just say, you do this, you do this, you do this, see if you look at the charts, it's all going to work out. No, you paint a vision. That's what being a leader is. You paint a vision over here, and you paint it in such beautiful colors that everyone is excited and everyone's desires are oriented towards that, and then they move as a team. So we talk about political campaigns. Think also of the advertising industry. If you guys have seen a car commercial or a perfume commercial or half the commercials that are out there, how much information are you actually getting? Very little, especially, you know, the car and the perfume commercials. You just see a car like going in the wilderness driving and you're like, okay, like what are the safety metrics here? What's going on? But it's because they know that people fundamentally aren't going to be making decisions on that. Fundamentally, they're trying to give you a narrative. They're trying to paint a picture of adventure, of freedom, and hope that you attach their product to that picture. Or with a perfume commercial, it's even worse. You have like a video of a horse, and then there's a flower, and then there's a person smiling, and it's like, buy our perfume. It's like, what? But it's because they're trying to paint a picture. They're trying to, you know, paint the picture of excitement or romance or whatever it is and hoping that you associate that desire with their product. You know, advertising coffee, you have, you say this is our origin of this and here's the, you know, the breakdown of how the grinds work and all that stuff. No, you have a family sitting around a campfire drinking coffee and enjoying it. And that's what makes people want to buy the coffee. So all of these are subconsciously, they're selling you a picture of the good life. They're selling you a picture that you can desire, and then they're hoping that you attach your, you know, practices on that, that you buy their product. So these examples point out to two really important factors about this. If we are desiring beings, and if our desires work as this compass that guide our decisions, one is that our compasses can be off-center. We've all heard tons of sermon illustrations, and they're fantastic sermon illustrations. That's why you hear them so often about the pilot or the Navy ship person who has their compass off like a half a degree, and they travel the course of the world, and they end up like 3,000 miles from where they're supposed to be, or they crash into something. And it's just this half a degree or this 1 degree that's carried out over, you know, 3,000 miles, or the proverbial carried out through your life, that even that fraction of a degree off can take you into very different places than you wanted to be. And that's why the Proverbs tell us to guard our heart. The Proverbs tell us to ponder the path of our feet, because our desires can take us to places that we might not actually realize that we don't want to go. And it's not that the desires themselves are wrong, it's that they've latched onto something other than God. They've latched onto creation rather than the Creator. So that's one point, is that our desires can be off-kiltered. In fact, the world makes a living off of trying to reorient our desires to more, you know, perfectly align with their political agenda or their product or whatever have you. Two, our desires are not fixed. It's not a one and done, that I'm just born with this desire and I'm just going to keep trucking this way forever. No, our desires are not fixed. They're shaped and they're molded. Often at the subconscious level, but ideally at the conscious level. But our desires can change over time, and they can be shaped by the things around us and by the situations we find ourselves in, and especially by what we surround ourselves with. This is, again, why the scriptures say, guard your heart. Because if you're not guarding it, there's going to be a lot of things coming in that's starting to reorient what you ultimately long for, what your version of the good life is. And from that, you're going to, you know, seek out information, you're going to seek out how to be successful, all that stuff. But if you're going the wrong direction, none of that matters. And so the fact that our desires are not fixed, this is actually why advertisers spend literally hundreds of billions of dollars to put their product in front of you multiple times. As many times as, you know, you see in the train, or you're going on the T and you just see like JetBlue. There's no information, it's just JetBlue, JetBlue, JetBlue. But if you see that enough times over time, you start to, when I think of, you know, an air flight, it's like, oh, I want to go with JetBlue. So the advertising industry is spending billions of dollars to try and direct your attention to what they want it to be directed to. And so we are shaped by what we give our attention to. We're shaped by what we attend to. You can think of this in a really good way. In, I think it's 1 Corinthians 3:17. It's either 1 or 2 Corinthians. But it talks about us beholding the glory of Christ with unveiled faces. And as we behold the glory, we are transformed degree by degree into glory. And it's this, you know, very explicit connection between beholding something and being transformed into the image of what we are looking at. But that's also why those who attend to idols become like idols, is what the prophets and the Psalms tell us. They become deaf, they become blind, they become powerless. The things that we attend to and set our gaze on shape who we are. And so, there's a relationship between what we love and what we attend to. It's a very important point. There's a relationship between what we love, what we desire, and what we attend to. And on the one hand, it's very simple. You can tell what someone loves by what they attend to, by what they're giving their attention to. If you say, like, I love my wife, and the last time you saw her was 15 years ago, it's like, I don't know. You're not giving attention there. Or you say, like, I love this charity, it's the best charity ever, and you've never, you know, done anything for it. It's like, well, I don't know. Versus the person who's given their life in service of that charity, versus the person that brings their wife flowers home every day. It's like, you can see love manifesting by what you give attention to. And Jesus talks about this. Where your treasure is, there your heart is. And what's more valuable than our attention? Indeed, I want to express it. Not just valuable in this abstract, like, feel-good sense, but actually monetarily valuable. That this, the attention economy is worth hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. These are the places where your attention is bought, packaged, and sold. The places where content creators are competing to try and get attention on their content. The places that harness and the collective power of, like, all the technology we have available to try and get you to look for 15 seconds longer. Because there's money to be made in attention, because the advertising industry knows, but attention is incredibly valuable. And Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart is. And so if you're saying, you know, I love my wife and I love Jesus, and 90 hours of your day are spent watching sports, and you forgot your wife's middle name, and you haven't gone to church in a year, that's very telling. Okay, so all this leads to the other side of the equation. So you can tell what someone loves by what they attend to, but what we attend to actually shapes what we love. And so there's this kind of relationship back and forth. And so, again, think of that picture of beholding Christ, transforming degree by degree into glory. Even the exhortations, like in Philippians, to think on these things, whatever is good, whatever is true, whatever is beautiful, whatever is all this stuff, because this idea is implicit that you are shaped by what you give your attention to. And this is why you see the importance of habits and virtues and practices being developed throughout the scripture. So just to go through a few, there's a lot in there. The Shema, the Hear, O Israel. I'll read it real quick. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts, notably. They are to be on your hearts. Okay, so what does that mean? Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. This idea that we're to take this fundamental idea of what's separating us from the nations, you know, talking about Israel here, the Lord our God is one. The Lord our God is one. And we're to surround ourselves with that. So our attention is constantly directed towards that. When I'm getting up, when I'm getting down, when I'm talking to my friend, when I'm talking to my child, when I come home from work past the gate, when I enter the threshold of my house. This idea that if you put that in someone's attention, they will slowly and slowly but surely be shaped. You see this partially in Acts, where Peter and John, they go up to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. And so in Second Temple Judaism, there were 3 hours of prayer every single day that people would go up and pray together. And again, this daily rhythm, this daily habit, you could almost call it, dare I say, a liturgy. But this daily habit, this daily action where people are coming to focus their attention. And as they do that day in, day out for a lifetime, you become a certain type of person. Just as a fun fact, those 3 hours of prayer, so morning, evening, night, they're based off of Daniel, who prayed 3 times a day, and also based off of David in the Psalms, who says he prays 3 times a day. And they're corresponding to the sacrifices. So there was a morning sacrifice, an evening sacrifice, and that evening sacrifice was to be continually offered throughout the night. The burning was supposed to go on. So this idea that you're not just doing it by yourself, but you're participating in the whole community at these times, every single day, day in, day out, day in, day out. And you can imagine the type of person that that produces. That because you're focusing your attention on something, you become a type of person. This is actually carried over into the early church. The Didache tells Christians to pray the Lord's Prayer 3 times a day. And also praying the Psalms throughout all of church history. This idea that we're supposed to be praying the Psalms and surrounding ourselves with this. This idea that, again, what we focus our attention on shapes us, and so be very intentional about what you're surrounding yourself with. And just as a, you know, aside, some people get very uncomfortable with like, oh, pray 3 times a day, pray this prayer, do whatever. Firstly, you know, it's in the scriptures. But second, someone said, oh, you're just praying words that like don't correspond to your life. You're just saying these words. The theologian Richard Hooker responded by saying that's actually, these words fill us with new realities. So even if I was doing, you know, poorly X, Y, and Z during the day, the very fact that I'm praying the Psalms puts my attention on something new and brings me back to a different reality. So this idea that your extemporaneous spirituality doesn't have to be the glass ceiling of your spiritual life. Even if you're not, quote, feeling it, you can still pray the Lord's Prayer, and you should pray the Lord's Prayer. You can still pray the Psalms. You should pray the Psalms. Okay, so I hope you're all following so far. That what we attend to shapes our loves. And what we love ultimately shapes our life, because that's our compass, that's where we're going. This also gets into the importance of the commandments that Jesus gives us. You know, the commandments are important for a lot of reasons. They're the way of life, they are, you know, how to live rightly in the world, they are, you know, the means by which we escape judgment, like a lot of things. But even more than that, they are a stepping stone to a relationship. And what do I mean by that? I've preached on this before, but 1 Peter 1:22 says, since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit, in sincere love of the brethren, love one another, X, Y, and Z. But there's this association that Peter makes with purity and obedience, that if you obey the commandments, you are purifying yourself. What do we know from Jesus? For the pure in heart, those are the ones that can see God. So blessed are the pure in heart, for they see God. And so by obedience, you become a different type of person. You become the type of person who is trained to see God. Just like an aficionado is trained by years and years of practicing, you know, they taste, you know, the golden spoon of ice cream and they can detect 50 different flavors versus you who does, and it's just like, I don't know, it just tastes like ice cream. That's the person who follows the commandments. They can see God in every single way that he's working because they've been purified. They become the type of person that can see God. All throughout a lot of the ascetical literature of the church talks about the commandments being a means of purification. And so if you look at it in this light, obedience is important for all those other reasons, but it's also important in that it's a stepping stone to a relationship with God, that we can't even be the type of person who has a relationship with God until we begin by purifying ourselves, X, Y, and Z. Okay, so that is why our attention is so important, why we are to guard our hearts, because we are shaped by what we give attention to. Excuse me. And this is why we are to add virtue to our faith. We start with faith. We start with belief, you know, the desire, the belief in God, the desire that things can be better. And then from there, we start to practice that. We don't just add knowledge immediately, we practice it. We add the virtues of almsgiving. We add the virtues of obedience. We add the virtues of prayer. We add the virtues, all of these actions over and over and over and over, because those are the things that shape our very desires. And if we orient our desires right, if we can orient our desires towards God correctly, then we add in, you know, knowledge, then we add all these other things. And this gets to this idea of virtue, which I should have mentioned before, but at least in Paul's time, we think of virtue as just vaguely like a good thing, like, oh, he had a virtue. But in Paul's time, a virtue was a habit. So a virtue was not just, you know, something that you were, but something that you put into practice and became. And so you don't decide one day to be a courageous man. You do repeated acts of courage over and over and over until you become a courageous man. And so it becomes a second nature, just who we are. And so you start with faith, and then you add virtue. You orient your compass aright, then you add knowledge, all of this X, Y, and Z. So I hope you're with me so far. Okay, so what do we do with all this? What are the takeaways of this type of anthropology, of this type of view of what it means to be human? You can hopefully tell, by the way, what the answer to the two examples that I gave at the beginning were. If not, I'll give it to you. But what's the answer for the person who wants to, you know, not eat the donut, or the person who really wants to slow down on work? I'll give the answer. Okay, it's not to add more information, to beat yourself up and say like, oh man, I know I should be doing this, but to put into practice, you know, start small, but the guy who overworks, consecrate 1 hour a week, a day, I don't know what it is, where you don't work, and just focus on that, like a laser focus, just on one simple practice. And then when you get that practice, add another one, and then add another one, and add another one, and soon, you know, maybe not soon, maybe medium, maybe long, you become the type of person that isn't overworking because you've been conditioned by all of these habits. You've added all these virtues into your life that now who you want to be is aligned with who you are. The guy who overeats, you know, start by taking the bad food out of your house. Start by every single time you sit down to a meal, I'm going to say the words, I desire to be healthy, whatever it is, and just make one small habit and really ingrain that into your character, into your nature. And then add another one, and then add another one, and you become the type of person who eats healthy. It's not just that you have to choose every single time, but after these repeated actions, these weeks, these months, these years of building habits, you don't just become someone who is trying to choose to be healthy, but you become a healthy person. Okay, so what are the takeaways? One is learning about the power of habit. that habits are so important. There's a lot of stuff in the productivity world, and I found that a lot of like the productivity world, they're like plundering the spiritual truths of the scriptures and other, you know, spiritual traditions. It's like all these wisdom pieces, and they're like, okay, let's just plunder these and use it to, you know, go do something. But there's a lot of good stuff there. The power of habit is so incredibly important. Because if we're shaped by what we attend to, you know, I choose what I pay attention to a lot of times during the day, but even more, there's just habits that I do. And so what about all the habits that I do just subconsciously without realizing it that start to add up over years and decades? So habits are like, let's see. Yeah. Habits are like wagon ruts, so to say. You guys know like the Oregon Trail where there's these like ruts that go deeper and deeper into the ground. They're like wagon ruts. And that's a good thing sometimes. Ultimately, what's the function of wagon ruts? You know, one, they just happen because of repeated action. But two, they take you somewhere. It actually makes it easier. If you can go on that path that's already been made with a rut, it's easier than trekking your own way. And so habits take you somewhere. They transform you. That can be a good thing or that can be a bad thing. But they're also like wagon ruts because they're hard to form and they're hard to break. And so we should be really careful and aware of what habits we have in our life, because there's a really great quote, habits may be small, but they are never neutral. Habits may be small, but they are never neutral. Every habit is some sort of little rut that is taking you somewhere, that's shaping your desire and is an expression of your desire. And so think about, you know, some guy in New York City, every morning he wakes up, has a cigarette, checks the news, has a cigarette before he goes to bed, checks the news. That's just what his life is. You know, that seems innocuous. You know, cigarettes, that's not healthy. You should put that away. But overall, like, whatever. But if you repeat that over years and years and decades, that actually shapes the type of person that he is. Versus you wake up and the first thing you do is read the scriptures, or you pray before you go to sleep, or you pray before your meals, or, you know, substituting other habits. Because all of these habits are like spirals. They're either spiraling you down or spiraling you up. And so this is the importance of the spiritual disciplines. It's not just like, I'm going to go, you know, do this one spiritual discipline and conquer it, and now I'm good to go. No, it's just this constant, repeated pattern that shapes who you are. James K.A. Smith, he says that, he talks about this in terms of liturgies. Like, everyone has liturgies. We all have them, even if you don't realize it. Like, that checking the news, like, but when you get up and when you go to sleep, that is your, quote, liturgy. That is your pattern. That's your habit, even if you don't realize it. And so one of the things that I would encourage all of us to do is to think of the habits that we do have. And again, it's not even like these big grand things of like, oh, I do this awesome thing. And I think of the subconscious habits, like, you know, even to get in a very visceral image, like every time you go to the bathroom, you end up checking Reddit or something. Like, that is a habit. Is it taking you somewhere you want to be? Maybe, maybe not. So think about what your habits are and think about where they're taking you. What are they transforming you into? And now think of it in light of the following phrase: your deepest desire is the one manifest by your daily habits. Your deepest desire is the one that's manifest by your daily habits. And to me, that's a really daunting phrase, because I have all these ideals and lofty things of like what I want to desire, but if you actually look at my life, a lot of times that falls short. As C.S. Lewis says, the problem with us is not that we have too strong of desires. It's kind of like the Puritans, like, oh, stop desiring this. You guys have all these bad desires. It's actually not that we have too strong desires. It's that we have too weak of desires. That instead of going for what God would have for me, I'm oftentimes too content just to sit and kind of zone out on something, and I'm content with that. That's my desire, is just simply to zone out. That my desire is not strong enough to have what God has for me. It's like kids sitting in a shack that are content to eat gruel while their father would want them to come to a mansion and eat, you know, a feast. But the kids are just satisfied. Their desires aren't strong enough. Okay, so one is to think of the habits that we have. You know, intentional habits, but especially unintentional habits. Where are they taking us? What are they transforming us into? And the other thing that I think can, should, you know, be a takeaway is to think of one virtue that you can add to your life. Just one. and start to put into place. Again, that could be anything. Maybe you don't pray before every meal, and you're just going to say, I will pray before every meal. Even something as small as that is something that's really helpful. A lifetime of that changes the type of person who you are. Maybe it's, you know, the first thing that I do in the morning is read one Bible verse, and then I check the news, check whatever, whatever. Just think of one virtue that you can start to add in your life. So that's one takeaway. You know, think of our habits, add a habit. The other is that we should be on the lookout for what Smith calls, quote, rival liturgies. We should be on the lookout for those potentially even more than we should be on the lookout for heresy. And so you can see the difference between one of them. Rival habits or liturgies is focused on practice. It's focused on what we ultimately desire. Heresies are focused on, like, knowledge. And again, I'm not saying, camera, I am not saying that heresies are not important. But so often, you can have all of the right information. You can believe everything to a T, but you are being shaped by habits and practices and liturgies that the world is giving you. That we have all the right ideas, but we still don't, quote, live Christianly. And it's well no wonder. Like, if you go to church on Sunday, you got all the ideas, you read through whatever systematic theology textbook, but you spend the rest of your week discipled by the mall, by social media, by sports, by the workplace, by whatever have you, all of those things are shaping what you desire. And so you get this epidemic, especially in the United States, of people who have, you know, okay doctrine that want to love God, but ultimately their desire is pointing to a picture of the good life that's not found in the scripture. It's found in the advertisements. It's found somewhere else. Their desire of the good life, you know, quote, the American dream, the white picket fence or something. And versus, what God would have for us, this life of service, community, the life of the cross, all of these things, the life of the resurrection. And so we should be on the lookout in our own lives and in each other's lives of what are the, quote, liturgies that are shaping us, that are reorienting our desires, that are moving our needles to and from. Even something as simple as going to the gym, like, it's a healthy activity, but if you don't watch out, you find yourself after, you know, years of going to the gym realizing, oh, I'm finding myself basing success off of, like, you know, aesthetics, off of looks, off of this, off of that. And it's because you've been, like, conditioned over time to view it that way. And so just be very aware of that. Okay. And then the other takeaway is to think or rethink our ideas of discipleship. That oftentimes I have seen discipleship carried out in such a way that it's like, if I can, you know, take the thumb drive and deposit it into that person's brain and just give them all of the scriptural knowledge that I have, they're going to be good to go. And that's generally not how it works, because we're not thinking things. You can give someone all the right information, but if their desires are set somewhere else, they're not going to budge. They're not going to move. And so incorporate this into our views of discipleship. This idea that teachers don't, like, legitimate teachers, and we've talked about this, Brother Finney's talked about this in the ministry of a teacher. A teacher isn't just someone who's depositing information. It's not just like, you know, the thumb drive model where it's like, I have information here, I'm going to transfer it to you. No, it's more than that. Teachers don't just provide content and information, but they also form and shape desires. They change the way a person thinks. They change the way a person is motivated. And so there's this idea that most of what we attend to, most of the things we desire for people that are not circumspect, and that's oftentimes many of us in different seasons, most of that's unconscious. And it's the church's job to make that conscious, to make us realize, wait a second, this whole time I've been thinking about about success and the good life as being a successful person in my field that does X, Y, and Z and has the esteem of the community. That's my vision of success. And it's because I've been shaped by these rival liturgies, these rival patterns of living, and my desire has been moved away. And so it's the church's job to help bring those patterns to light. And it's our job to do that for ourselves. This was actually evident in the early church, especially if you read a book by Alan Kreider, The Patient Ferment of the Early Church. He talks about the church's catechism process. And by, you know, the second, third century, it was a pretty long catechism process. It was 2 to 3 years of bringing someone into the church. What did that 2 to 3 years consist of? You know, it wasn't just information. In fact, they would save the deepest mysteries of the Christian faith until the very end. You can go back and read, like, they have all of these beautiful, powerful sermons and homilies that they give right before baptism, where they're starting to reveal the mysteries of the faith. And they have these beautiful sermons right after baptism. They're called mystagogies, if you're interested, where they're revealing the mysteries of the faith to people who have been baptized. And it's like, wait a second, you spent 2 or 3 years, what were you doing? Like, surely you should have told them about, you know, the incarnation and how that relates to the sacrament and how that relates to X, Y, and Z. And for the early church, most of their catechism process was focused on practice. Can you become the type of person? And again, there's theological critiques for this model, to be sure, but it's interesting to have in our mind. Can you develop the Christian way of living? And so the catechumens were, you know, assessed not based off of their, you know, eventually it was their assent to doctrine XYZ, but they were assessed on their almsgiving, on their moral purification. Were they cutting off sin? Were they giving to the poor? Were they praying and fasting? Were they developing this desire that was in sync with the desire of Christians as a whole? And so in our version of discipleship, I'm not recommending the 2 to 3 year catechism process, save the mysteries of the faith, XYZ, but I do think that we should, a central part of our discipleship when we're bringing people into the kingdom, when we're discipling each other, should be focused on desires. What is it that you ultimately desire? Discuss those desires and validate those desires even. Like there's no, this is an interesting, controversial take, but there's no bad desire. It's desires that are fulfilled in wrong ways. You can see this even when Jesus talks to the woman at the well. You know, she is going to get water, and he's like, well, where's your husband? I've had all these husbands. And she's been, you know, thirsting for something to satisfy something in her life. She's had 5 or 6 husbands, and Jesus is saying, I am the one who can satisfy that. You have all of these desires, maybe for relationship, maybe for security, maybe for intimacy, maybe for whatever it is, and your heart is going to be restless until it's at rest in me. And so we should make a discussion of desires and a reshaping of desires central to our discipleship. And so all of this to say, we are not fundamentally thinking things. And if God tried to make us that way, like he did a poor job because there's a lot of other stuff going on beyond just my thoughts, we are fundamentally desiring things. We are fundamentally creatures that love and act based off that love. And if that is true, we have to be very, very aware of what we do love. We have to guard our hearts. We have to ponder the path of our feet. Because salvation isn't just a one and done thing. It's not, you know, there's a lot, it's actually a critique sometime I have of hymnody from the 1700s. It's like this kind of revivalist, like, I've been saved. And it's like, yes, amen, amen, amen. But there's also really hard times of a Christian life where you're still being saved, you're still being formed, you're still being shaped. And so the goal of the Christian life isn't just something in the past where my sins have been forgiven, but it's being transformed and putting on the new man, putting on the new likeness, putting on the image of Christ and partaking in the divine nature. And all of that has to do with who and what we love and how we orient our lives. And so, all of this to say, we often attend to things we're not aware of. Our desires take us places we're not aware of. And this is a kind of, you know, exhortation to bring that to light and to be willing and able to reorient our desires. And again, how does this happen? Through virtue. Through adding virtue, these small actions, these practices, these habits over and over and over, and those carry us through a lifetime. That's even what's happening with this sermon. You know, that's part of what we do with sermons every Sunday. What was preached about 4 Sundays ago? Can anyone raise their hand and tell me? No one. Because, you know, now we live in the digital age, we can record sermons, and so that's a whole separate thing. But a lot of the function of a sermon isn't to just download information to you guys. I could have said this a lot more concisely. It's to shape desire. And so hopefully throughout this whole sermon, the function of it is that you maybe change one thing in your life this week, you forget about it next week, but because of that one change, it's orienting you on a different path for the rest of your life. And if you do that every single week, it starts to keep you on the right way. And so, yeah, all of that to say, we're not thinking things. We are desiring things. We attend to the things that we love, and the things that we attend to shape what we love. And there's a lot of people out there, a lot of forces out there that want to maximize the way that they can shape you in ways that are counter to who God would have for you. And so, be vigilant, be aware, and also be excited to reorient your lives to God and, yeah, direct your compasses to the one who can ultimately give rest, for whom we were made. Amen.